time. Five families live in the area. My neighbor often doesn't sleep in his house out of fear. The bomb is located about 30 meters from Abu Jarrah's home, where he lives with 11 family members, including 8 grandchildren. Abu Jarrah said, "Even going to the grocery is a perilous task. When I go out, the rocket and my grandchildren are still in my mind." Crews from the United Nations Mine Action Service, UNMAS, and Gaza's General Department of Forensic Evidence and Explosive Ordnance Disposal, or EOD, have visited the site and confirmed that the bomb has not exploded. Still, the Gaza-based teams have not been able to remove the bomb because it is so deeply buried. They must wait for the equipment and funding of UNMAS. The bomb has hindered all operations on Abu Jarrah's farm, the family's main source of income, since he can't access parts of his land. Abu Jarrah's dilemma is not an anomaly in Gaza, where 19 Palestinians were killed and 170 injured by explosive remnants of war from 2014 to 2020. According to the UN, 8,786 explosive remnants of war have been removed and destroyed since 2014. 7,000 of those remnants were from the Zionist regime's 2014 war. Major Ahmad Othman, the director of the technical unit of Gaza's EOD department, told the Electronic Intifada that the EOD team has carried out more than 300 field missions since May. On 32 occasions, those missions concerned Iron Dome missile remnants. By his unit's estimate, the Zionist regime dropped 277 tons of ordnance on Gaza during its May attacks. Without access to the latest ordnance removal equipment or advanced training abroad, due to the Israeli regime siege, Gaza's EOD teams often find themselves ill-equipped to dispose of Israeli regime ordnance. Othman said that 17 EOD team members have been killed while removing ordnance in the last two decades. Othman himself lost several fingers while disposing of unexploded ordnance in 2018. He said, "The EOD is completely civilian and we need the equipment to rescue people." The EOD has appealed to international bodies to pressure the Zionist regime into allowing the much-needed equipment. The Electronic Intifada joined Othman's EOD team on a mission in the eastern Gaza neighborhood of Zeytun in July. After almost 3 hours of combining the area under the scorching sun, the four-member crew found an Iron Dome missile that had been launched in May 2023. The crew used ropes to move the explosive remnants. Othman said, "We don't have any bomb suits due to the siege. We use ropes to move the explosive remnants. Although this is a very primitive way, because we don't have robots or modern equipment. The crews have only a single four-wheel cart to facilitate ordnance transportation. And due to the lack of bulldozers, they use shovels and other basic tools for excavation. Once removed, the ordnance is then loaded onto the beds of their trucks, which are not shrapnel-proof." Othman noted that the lack of equipment puts crews' lives at risk, and yet another challenge faced by the crews is that they are not able to extract the buried ordnance. Othman said, "We don't have equipment. We can't pull out deep buried bombs. We have to wait for UNMAS to work on fully funded projects." While the EOD teams and UNMAS have disposed of dozens of deep buried bombs in recent years, Osman said there are still at least 70 buried bombs in Gaza. To dispose of the unexploded ordnance, the crews use explosive material to detonate it off-site. He said, "We still have dozens of unexploded Israeli regime white phosphorus bombs since 2008, and we still don't know how to dispose of them. The needed explosive material is missing in Gaza, and the Zionist regime has refused to let it enter." Ayman Shamlaka, the owner of Al Baida Resort on the coast of Gaza City, is still waiting for an EOD team to remove unexploded ordnance from his property. In February 2023, the Zionist regime targeted the resort with a barrage of rockets, reducing it to ruins. Shamlaka said, "Israel claimed the place was used for military purposes." Shamlaka noted that there is no truth to this claim. He ran the resort for 25 years, and it was his primary source of income, earning around $50,000 a year. Yet now, there is a bomb buried deep in the ground, and he cannot begin reconstruction on his resort or remove any rubble until the ordnance is excavated. This was not the first time the Zionist regime attacked his resort, which is located near a Palestinian military outpost. The resort was also damaged during Israeli regime attacks in 2012, 2014, and 2021. He said, "Each damage would cost me from $10,000 to $20,000. The place cost me $1 million to build." Salah Abdul Ati, the director of the International Commission to Support Palestinians' Rights, said that the Zionist regime's use of white phosphorus bombs, vacuum bombs, and suicide drones puts Palestinians at exceptional risk. As the top supplier of military aid to Israeli regime, $3.8 billion annually, the United States regime is equally culpable. Referring to the Zionist regime's unlawful employment of white phosphorus and other attacks, Abdul Ati stated, "Israel intentionally uses internationally banned weapons in densely populated areas in Gaza. Israel has used the Palestinian territories, especially Gaza, as a testing ground for its weapons." Mohammad Mosleh, director of the Environmental Protection Unit at Gaza's Water Environmental Quality Authority, said, "The Israeli ordnance dropped on Gaza is an exceptionally perilous and noxious threat to the environment." Mosleh, who participated in a study examining the destructive impact of the Zionist regime's 2014 war on Gaza's environment, noted that the bombings have contaminated crops and destroyed soil quality in agricultural areas. He said, "Rainfall causes the toxic components to seep into the groundwater," noting that deep buried bombs pose a significant threat to the people and the environment. Back in Beit Hanun, on Abu Jarrah's farm, the May 2023 bombing destroyed 50 olive trees and numerous seedlings, contaminating the soil with toxic components and harming the productivity of the farm. Farmer Abu Jarrah said, "Trees can't grow where the rockets bombed. When I run the tap water, which is from a well, I clearly see the gray and black polluted water."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, being lenient with our family members and our friends in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here in your presence, dear listeners. We are talking about how we need to be lenient with our family members and our friends in our Islamic lifestyle. Now, leniency, of course, is this kind of, being lenient, not being very rough and not being very stern and strict as some people are, right? Islam is a religion of peace. It is a religion of love. It is a religion of discipline. It is a religion of organization. It is a discipline. It is a religion of cleanliness, of appropriateness, of nobility, of honor, and many other beautiful things. But sometimes we have this kind of a thinking, or we have this idea or this image that Islam is a religion which is, you know, always has a frown on their face, and they're always really, you know, overly serious, and they'll reprimand you on everything. This is, for the most part, if not for the whole part, propaganda made by the enemies of Islam. No, Islam is a religion in which the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, says to us that the most simplest and basic form of charity is to have a smile on your face. So even if you don't have money, if you don't have wealth, if you don't have status, if you don't have anything that you can give away to people as a charity, the most fundamental thing that you can do is to put a smile on your face. And you know what? Put a smile on another person's face as well. Now, as putting a smile on your own face as well as other people's face does not come around with, severe admonition and reprimanding and, you know, punishment and these kind of things, even though they have their own place. Still, being lenient is something that is very important in our Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about being lenient with our family members and our friends in our Islamic lifestyle. Now, we were talking about how, you know, being lenient, meaning, let's just kind of give some examples. Well, before we give examples, it's important to note that being lenient with somebody who is an open enemy of Islam, that's something that's not allowed, right? We're not, because if you be lenient with somebody who's an open enemy of Islam, then they're going to come and, you know, most probably kill you. So that's a different story, and that's a different program that we need to talk about. That is how to behave with people who are the open enemies of Islam. Now, we're not talking about fighting physically against them, but being lenient is also not an option. Well, regardless, we're talking about family members and friends, people who are our close circle individuals. We have to be lenient with them, right? We have to realize and examples that, you know, a child is going to create a mess. A child is going to, color up the wall. They're going to write and draw on the wall. Or a child is going to break, a piece of cookingware or a glass or, a bowl or something, These are things which are part of life. We have to realize that children, they might lie, and we need to teach them how to not lie. Or, somebody might make a mistake, and we have to be lenient. And here, one of the things that we're going to have to do is we have to realize in a position where we are faced with a family member or a close friend, and we want to get really angry for whatever reason, we have to remember that if we are lenient with this believer, if we are lenient with this Muslim brother or sister, if we are lenient with this family member or this close friend of ours, then in turn, the Almighty Allah will be lenient towards us in the hereafter. And this is the importance of being lenient with our family members and our close friends when it comes to a Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
The mugshot of former U.S. President Donald Trump was made public shortly after he left a jail in Fulton County, Georgia. His former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and others have also surrendered. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump surrendered on Thursday, 24th of August, at the Fulton County Jail, where he was booked on 13 felony counts related to an alleged scheme to overturn the results of the presidential election in Georgia in 2020. His surrender in Georgia marks the fourth time this year the former president has turned himself in after criminal charges were brought against him by federal and state officials. But it's the first time he was subjected to a mugshot. It's also routine for defendants in Fulton County, Georgia, to be fingerprinted and have their eyes scanned for biometric identification. Within an hour after he boarded his plane to leave Atlanta, Donald Trump's Save America PAC sent a fundraising email featuring his booking photo on a T-shirt. Trump also posted the mugshot on his X account, formerly known as Twitter, as well as to Truth Social, both posts with the words election interference and never surrender. It marked Trump's first tweet since 8th of January 2021, 2 days after the 6th of January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The booking process was quick, just about 30 minutes, since Trump's attorneys and prosecutors had agreed earlier this week to a $200,000 bond. The conditions of the agreement in part prohibit Donald Trump from intimidating his co-defendants, witnesses or alleged victims in the case, including on the social media platforms. Inmate records from the Fulton County Sheriff's Office list Donald Trump as 6 feet 3 inches tall and 215 pounds in weight. His hair colour is described as blonde or strawberry, and his eyes blue. Before he boarded his plane back to New Jersey, the former president told reporters that he and his co-defendants did nothing wrong and said it was a very sad day for America. "You should be able to challenge an election," he said. "I thought the election was a rigged election, a stolen election, and I should have every right to do that." Ahead of his surrender, Trump made changes to his legal team, bringing in Stephen Seddo, an Atlanta lawyer who specializes in white-collar and high-profile defense. Stephen Seddo entered his appearance as lead counsel for Trump on Thursday, according to a filing with the Fulton County Superior Court, and accompanied Donald Trump to jail. ABC News was first to report the change. Stephen Seddo is expected to replace Drew Feindling, the lead attorney on Trump's defense team. Feindling did not return a request for comment. Trump, who has denied any wrongdoing, did not appear in court on Thursday to enter a plea because the booking and arraignment processes are separate in Fulton County, Georgia. It's unclear when Trump will appear before a judge to be arraigned. District Attorney Fannie Willis has proposed Trump and his 18 co-defendants be arraigned the week on 5th of September, but the judge has not yet approved that request. Trump was working with a local bonding company to cover his $200,000 bond. Charles Shaw, the chief executive officer of Foster Bail Bonds LLC in Lawrenceville, Georgia, assisted Donald Trump in covering the cost of the bond. Defendants only need to put up 10% of the bail amount, $20,000 in this case for former President Trump, and the company will be paid a fee for posting the bond. The arrangements were made remotely earlier this week, Foster Bail Bonds confirmed. CNN was the first to report that Donald Trump is using a bail bond company. CNN cable news network has also covered the same story. Donald Trump surrendered on Thursday, 24th of August, at the Fulton County Jail on more than a dozen charges stemming from his efforts to reverse Georgia's 2020 election results. The fourth time this year, the former president has faced criminal charges. Trump spent a little more than 20 minutes at the Fulton County Jail, where he was processed and released on bond. Jail records showed him at 6'3" tall and weighing 215 pounds, with blue eyes and blonde or strawberry hair. His booking number was PO1135809. A mugshot of Donald Trump was released soon after he left the jail. Trump's surrender in Georgia marks the fourth time this year the former president has turned himself in to local or federal officials after criminal charges were brought against him. Episodes that had never been seen in the U.S. before 2023. The scene of Trump traveling to be arrested while denouncing the charges against him as politically motivated repeated itself again on Thursday, 24th of August, but that still didn't shake the remarkable and unprecedented scene of a former president and a leading GOP candidate for the White House in 2024 facing a criminal indictment. Trump called being at the jail a terrible and very sad experience in an interview later on Thursday with Newsmax. He said, "In my whole life I didn't know anything about indictments and now I've been indicted four times." In April, Trump was booked in New York on state charges related to a hush money scheme. In June, he surrendered at a Miami, Florida federal courthouse to face charges in special counsel Jack Smith probe into his mishandling of classified documents. And earlier this month, Donald Trump was placed under arrest in Washington, D.C. and arraigned on charges brought by special counsel Jack Smith in his investigation into attempts to overturn the 2020 election. All of those cases could come to a head next year at the same time that Trump is running for president. Like most of his 18 co-defendants in the sprawling racketeering case, who have already surrendered at the jail, Donald Trump was quickly processed through the facility because the former president and his lawyers have already negotiated his consent bond agreement. Trump agreed to a $200,000 bond and other release conditions, including not using social media to target the co-defendants and witnesses in this case. Trump covered the cost of his $200,000 bond by putting up 10% towards it and working with a local Atlanta bonding company called Foster Bell Bonds LLC, according to sources. Trump departed his Bedminster, New Jersey golf club for Georgia on Thursday afternoon, touching down in Atlanta, Georgia on his private plane in the evening. NBC News has also covered the same story. Donald Trump turned himself in for arrest at the Fulton County Jail on Thursday evening on felony charges in connection with efforts to overturn Georgia's 2020 presidential election results. He quickly became the biggest thing on social media with the release of his historic mugshot. Although he's been indicted four times this year, the Georgia case is the first time with a booking photo. While plenty of Trump's critics were eagerly awaiting the mugshot, Trump and his presidential campaign decided to embrace the notoriety as well. He returned to his one-time favorite social media platform, Twitter, which is now known as X, for the first time since he was kicked off it in January of 2021. Trump posted his mugshot, a link to his website, and the words, "Election interference and never surrender." His campaign quickly started selling mugshot T-shirts, and Trump senior advisor Chris Lacivita tweeted a warning to any scammers who might try to raise money off the photograph. "We are coming after you," he wrote, adding, "You will not scam donors." He's defiant, an aide traveling with Donald Trump said of the former president's mood on Thursday night.
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam ID. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, my dear sisters and brothers from all around the world. Welcome back to a new episode of
Youth Station.
This is Asma, it's your service, and there is Vita.
Vita here again, our sweet home.
Yeah, of course. It's so, so happy and pleasurable to be here with you.
Exactly, and we're all honored to be here.
Same in here.
As, I don't know, everything, as our friends, you know, again here is a blessing for me. Every week, every day.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Thank you.
I hope everything goes well for you and for all the audience out there. And I hope life is going so smooth. Life is a sugar-coated pill. Let's just call it that way. It's going to be more easier. Are you a kind of a person who talks about her sadnesses?
Not that much. I don't know whether this is a good thing or not, but I'm not that kind of person who can talk easily. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter about what. You know, it depends on the person I'm talking to. I mean, like I have to put a lot of trust to somebody to start talking about my personal things, you know?
Yeah, I get that.
And generally speaking of these sort of things, there is this, you know, Freud's theory that you have to talk about your dark parts of your personality and you have to show them.
I'm not sure he said you have to say it to everyone.
No, he meant to say it
to a psychiatrist.
Yeah, to a therapist or, I don't know,
someone who's a specialist.
But even I don't believe in that.
Well, honestly speaking, I would have the same perspective, but then we have to add the very fact that sometimes these doctors, psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, mentor, whoever you want to call it, they do the same thing. They would just work as a person who would just moderate or ease the pain that you have.
I know what you mean, but there is always this bug on my mind that, okay, I'm paying you money for just talking to me. What does that mean? I don't like it. Yeah. You know? They're like trading or something, and it's like I'm trading my feelings and emotions and my personal life to you.
Now, putting those people aside, well, if you do that to your friend, does that do you any good?
What do you mean?
I mean, if you talk about your sadnesses with your friends or with your family members, with your relatives, does that just look to be something beneficial?
You know, whenever I talk to my friends about my personal things and sadnesses and so on, after maybe 2 hours, I feel so regretful. You know, because of that, I'm trying to actually stop this habit of mine that I go to my friends and talk about my difficulties. So instead, I replace my mother, you know, to talk to.
You're sure about her.
Exactly. I'm sure about her. You know, it's not like she's confidential or something because she's going to tell my father everything. But, you know, it's like I'm okay with that.
That's a mother's do.
Yeah, but, you know.
But again, this is actually their strategy to help their children. Because they think if they tell the fathers about the problems that their kids have, then together they're going to solve the problem easier.
You know, sometimes you don't really want your father to know about these kind of things. And
I get that.
Yeah. I tell her, okay, you shouldn't tell father about these. And the other day I see her, like, telling everything, with every details she wants to my father.
Now, the weirdest thing is that we would go for them again and again.
Yeah,
though we
exactly.
know they
you know, because
that.
They are the safest persons.
Yeah, they are the safest person.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Oh, yes. Bita and I are in here, and this is Youth Station, IRIB English Radio. Well, we're talking about, is it good to tell our sadnesses to other people or the dark things that we have in a corner of our minds to every single person? I guess as human beings, we too can share some of the perspectives that the audience might have. Now, I just told you that I'm going to tell you about my experience with my friend. There was this colleague of ours at university, and then she was such a person whom just when she saw you at the very beginning, at the very start of the day, she started nagging.
Oh my gosh. I know these
She started nagging and nagging and nagging. And you can't imagine. Her face, to me, was just a symbol of all the sad things that could ever happen in the world.
Yeah.
Sharing our sad stories with other people might be good, and at the very same time, it might give them some negative feelings.
Exactly. You know, I think sometimes you're telling other people your sad parts of the life, and after, I don't know, a long time, you're going to get used to that. You're going to get used to telling other people every little thing that annoys you, you know? Mm-hmm. And this is a problem, because sometimes you have to go through the difficulties and darkness of life alone.
Yeah.
And this loneliness sometimes is the remedy for real pain.
Actually, you're not alone, as in so alone. Sheerly alone? No, it's not like that. I guess if you just confine to the one and only who's the mightiest of all, then you are not going to feel lonely. But then, Bita, there's another point.
Yeah.
You're my friend, and when I have a problem, I come to tell you. We're so close. So when I tell you about my sadnesses and my problems, I would feel like alleviated. I would feel like I'm lighter. There is no burden on my shoulder. But the problem starts when it becomes my habit.
Yeah.
When I come towards you for even the little problems that I have in my life and I just try to make a big ado about them and then make them look like catastrophes.
You know, it's kind of addiction, in my opinion.
When exactly.
You go to people and tell every little and tiny things that you feel annoyed by.
Yeah.
And there is this beautiful quote by Imam Ali, peace be upon him, I think. I'm not sure. He says, like, just don't tell everything to everyone. Maybe they're going to become your enemy one
exactly.
day.
Exactly. Okay? Even your friends, yeah.
Yeah.
Because there's a big chance for them to become your worst enemies.
Yeah. You're not sure about people and how they would behave towards your difficulties and so on. And you have to keep that in mind that they don't care that much. You know, they have their own problems.
Unfortunately,
even if they don't tell you, they have their own problems and difficulties facing in their lives. So you have to stop it.
Yeah.
And you have to find, you know, another way, like writing. Writing mm-hmm. is one of the best remedies for these
exactly.
actually disease to
yeah.
tell the people difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there are better things to be replaced.
Yeah, I do believe so. But we have to go for a break. Welcome back, guys. You're listening to Youth Station. Well, yes, writing also can do miracles.
Yeah.
I suppose it would work so good. It's
yeah.
even better than telling to other people because whenever you feel regretful, you can just go to your diary notebook and then tear that paper apart.
Yeah, exactly.
Without and worrying about the consequences.
I was telling you a but thing. And yeah. You know, there should be a
There's
bias
There's a but
here.
Before we go for a break.
Exactly.
And then now you have to fill that.
There should be a balance between these two. I mean, telling to talking to other people and writing, going to nature or something like that. It shouldn't be like a kind of complex to you.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that you are sad about, everything that you are annoyed by. Sometimes people get used to not tell anyone anything. And this
yeah.
is a disaster itself.
Yeah, this would cause some sort of very severe disease.
Exactly. And I think the damages that it will cause is somehow more severe. Than the other
yeah,
part that you tell
I do
other
believe
people
so.
Think. You know, when you tell the people difficulties and sadness, it feels like, you know, you make them sad too.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't tell them, this sadness will kind of get stuck in your heart. And
exactly.
your heart is kind of filled with everything.
You know, there is
yeah.
someone in every one of our lives
I know.
That we trust more than anybody else. So
exactly.
that someone is the person whom we would go to them and tell them everything. The fact that they're just looking you in the eye
yeah,
and then
they're
telling you,
you
that everything is going to be okay and you're going to pass this as well. So you feel like everything is over and you don't feel sad anymore.
Yeah.
So speaking to those people, I guess, does not have any problem, except for in life, there's a fact we should just always think about it and take care of it. The fact that, as you just said it, sometimes in our lives, we have to go through things by our own selves.
Yeah, I know.
And it does not mean that we're alone. No, there's always God and He's always there to help us pull through. So it does not mean that we're that alone, but
exactly.
it depends on how you look at things.
And everybody has their journeys, you know, and life is your own journey. You cannot just put the responsibility of your life on other people,
exactly.
On other people's actually shoulders. So
mm-hmm.
stop it.
Yeah,
know?
And we also have it in our religion, you know, just as
yeah.
you said it, we have it that if you keep your sadnesses, even your happinesses for yourself, it's going to be better because there is always these kind of evil thought people who are looking
yeah.
around and they want to do you harm. I don't want to mean that, okay, life is filled with too much of misery around you. You shouldn't trust anyone. No, I just mean that sometimes we're not aware of everything.
Yeah, I get the point. And I think you mentioned something really beautiful. When you're filled with the love of Allah Almighty and the belief that everything that is happening in my life is like kind of an examination, you know, it's not going to be a big misery.
Yeah.
I mean, you can deal with it.
You know, I was just thinking about the poem by Edgar Allan Poe, who tells a beautiful poem about life. And then he says, life is, I'm just giving you the main idea now. I don't remember it just literally. A life is all dream within a dream.
Yeah.
So just if you think of life as dreams that come one after each other, then I think everything is going to get easier for you. There's an ending point to it.
You know, it's not like sitting somewhere and drinking your coffee and feel like, okay, it's not going to last forever, so I don't care. No, it's not like
that.
No,
of course not. We are breathing beings. We feel. We have emotions.
There is this key point that you have to keep the balance between everything, whether it is about telling other people your difficulties or not telling them, or caring about things or not caring about things. There should be a balance here.
The thing is, when you look at things,
yeah,
specifically the problems and the sadnesses that you have from a larger scale, then you would understand that, okay, this thing, no matter how big it is, eventually it's going to end. And in the end, when it is over, when we are over it, then when we look back, we see that maybe it was a trivial thing and I shouldn't have put that much of thought on it.
And I think we forgot some really important thing to say here, which is praying, you know?
This,
talking to Allah Almighty. I mean, talking, literally talking.
Yeah, just looking as He's the one you're going to...
In front of you.
Yeah, share everything with.
You can share everything with Him, you know, without the fear of, I don't know, being...
Him turning against you, stabbing you from the back, or doing you any harm.
A strong source of love and beauty.
Exactly. So there are two perspectives. There are some people who do believe that we have to share everything with other people because we should not keep anything in our mind, because then eventually they're going to turn into traumas. But there are some people who also believe that you don't have to share everything, literally everything, with everyone. And I guess life needs moderation and balance. So if you have that one person in your life that you can trust more than anyone else, then you are a lucky person. You can share your sadnesses with those people. But again, as my own perspective, I would say that it's not cool to share everything, all of your burdens, with other people, because sometimes you have to go through them all alone. With your own God, and that's it. The only army you need at your back is God Himself. And I guess He suffices, because He's enough.
He is enough for sure.
Yeah, you just have to work on your perspective and the way you look at things. And the concept of lonesome is something that is defined by yourself. Try to define it in a way that is the truest way, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is your story, and nobody is going to write it for you.
Yeah.
You have to go through that. You have to go through all these difficulties, and these difficulties is special for you.
Yeah.
And this is specifically your life.
Yeah, these are specifically made for you.
Yeah, exactly. Don't make it public.
Yeah, don't make it public, because it's not going to do you any good, I suppose. Maybe at the very beginning, yes, but then in the end, maybe regret comes in the middle.
You'll regret it.
So, yes, again, we're running out of time. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until another session, I just bid you farewell from me and from Bita.
Yeah.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The scale of the rebellion against the British government appears to be in part driven by the spiralling cost of living, with a separate analysis seen by the British media showing the crisis is having a devastating impact on Tory-held seats in the Red Wall. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Conservatives are facing electoral oblivion in the Red Wall as a shock poll revealed they will lose every single seat. Polling from Electoral Calculus, shared with The Independent, reveals all 42 Red Wall seats held by the Conservatives are set to return to Labour at the next general election. The scale of the rebellion against the government appears to be in part be driven by the spiralling cost of living crisis, with a separate analysis seen by The Independent showing the crisis is having a devastating impact on Tory-held seats in the Red Wall. The data compiled by analytics from Outre showing 15 Conservative-held Red Wall seats, which were won at the last election but have historically supported the Labour Party, are among the 50 constituencies with the highest number of financially distressed voters in the country, such as Great Grimsby, Blackpool South and Walsall North, are among those with the highest portion of voters deemed financially vulnerable. In total, 15 of the top 50 seats in which voters are at risk of falling behind on their bills were won by the Conservatives in 2019. It follows research by investment firm Hargreaves Lansdowne that shows the North East has been hit hard by the cost of living crisis, with a joint lowest level of savings in the country and just a third of households reporting they have enough cash left at the end of the month. The figures will set alarm bells ringing at number 10 Downing Street, with experts warning that voters facing financial distress will make their voices heard at the ballot box. Pollster and political analyst Robert Hayward pointed to a defining phrase from Bill Clinton's successful 1992 run to unseat George H.W. Bush as U.S. president. "It's the economy, stupid," he told The Independent, that the economy is always the most important issue on polling day across all age groups, social groups and genders. Robert Hayward said it was especially important for the Conservatives, who always claimed they have historically been considered better managers of the economy than Labour. He warned the government has to restore that credibility. Robert Hayward added that Rishi Sunak's party may be doing so slowly, with inflation finally falling, but without further progress before an expected general election in October of 2024, the Conservatives will lose. The website Reddit has also covered the same story. YouGov polling shows almost two-thirds of British voters believe the economy to be one of the top three issues facing the country, putting it significantly ahead of healthcare and immigration. The risk of a Red Wall wipeout will also raise fears in Conservative headquarters, with Lord Hayward warning it will leave Rishi Sunak facing serious difficulty securing an overall majority. Addressing the collapse in support facing the Tories in the Red Wall, Lord Hayward said that while the party has achieved majorities without the voting bloc in the past, it delivered the size of that majority last time around. He added that a failure to win those seats next year would leave the Conservatives in serious difficulty trying to find an overall majority. Electoral Calculus Chief Executive Martin Baxter pointed to former Prime Minister Boris Johnson's acknowledgement that Red Wall voters had lent him their support in 2019. He stated, "And it looks like they're taking it back." The Conservative tide went up that beach in 2019, and it looks like the tide is going out again. The pollster is forecasting that the Tories will lose all 42 of their Red Wall seats. Martin Baxter said that while the economic figures underline the struggle in voters in those areas for the Conservatives, the prospect of the party holding on to power in the general election is already not likely. Nationally, Electoral Calculus predicts a landslide Labour victory, winning around 460 seats, with the Conservatives reduced to just 90 seats. Many Red Wall seats were turned blue in 2019 as voters, repulsed by the Labour leader at the time, Jeremy Corbyn, backed Boris Johnson to get Brexit done and level up neglected towns and cities. But Outre's figures show that in many of those seats, voters are now feeling the pinch of the cost of living squeeze. In Great Grimsby, which Boris Johnson loyalist Iannucci won from Labour's Melanie On in 2019, more than a quarter of constituents are at risk of financial distress. Melanie On, who is Labour's candidate hoping to win back Great Grimsby next year, said the figures laid bare the reality of life under the Conservatives. She added, areas like ours that placed trust in the Tories have been hit the hardest. Their economic mismanagement has caused incomes to nosedive, revealing a disregard for ordinary working people. In Blackpool South, held by suspended Tory MP Scott Benton, just under a quarter risk not being able to meet payments. And in Walsall North, represented by Eddie Hughes, 23.1% of voters are at risk of financial distress. Other Tory MPs believed to be vulnerable to losing their seats include Jonathan Gullis, Johnny Mercer and Jack Brereton. Exclusive polling by Omnisys found 62% of Britons believe the United Kingdom's economy is getting worse, with a mere 11% saying it's getting better. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak recently claimed there is light at the end of the tunnel, with average weekly pay going up by 7.8% in the 3 months to June. But voters still think the country is heading into trouble. This is despite the latest figures showing inflation slowing down to 6.8% in the year to July. With Labour Party at 36% in the polls and the Conservatives on 23%, the Prime Minister is under pressure to close the gap ahead of the next general election. The government is now facing calls to accelerate economic growth.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on August 6, 2023, with a meeting with the commander's crew and families of the 86th flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. What I want to say is that the political value of your work was no less than its military value. The fact that you were able to carry out such a large task on the sea, that you demonstrated Iran possesses this amount of power, this number of young people, this scientific capability and this vast amount of skill, which allowed it to accomplish such a great task, brought about international status for the country. The next point is that there are several lessons to be learned from this seafaring. It had significant lessons. The first lesson is that it teaches us about God. The sea is one of the clear signs of God's experience. In the supplication of Joshan al-Kabir, it is written, O he who possesses wonders in the sea. The sea is the center of the wonders of creation. The majesty of the sea, the infiniteness of the oceans, the beauty of the various sights at sea, the fury of the sea in some places, the grace of the sea, and the amazing sea creatures are all divine signs. These are all signs of God. The sea is actually an exhibition of God's signs. So the first lesson of this seafaring is that it teaches us about God. A person's belief in God is strengthened. One sees the divine signs.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The second lesson is a lesson about the revolution. The seafaring shed light on the value and importance of Iran's Islamic revolution for us, for you, and for everyone who becomes aware of your story. Why? Because it was the revolution that gave us this knowledge, capability, and self-confidence. The revolution gave us the determination and courage to carry out such a great mission. There was not even a mention of these kinds of things before the revolution. During the period of Pahlavi and Qajar rule, we had no knowledge about the sea and its capacities, despite the country's vast coastal areas and maritime resources. The navy was preoccupied with other things. Fortunately, you didn't experience those days. There were some fair, honest people who told us what's going on in the navy back then. There were no signs of these kinds of achievements back then.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Cancer patients in Gaza staged a sit-in protest to condemn the Israeli blockade that has taken its toll on their lives. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before they even can access treatment. Hospitals in Gaza grapple with a severe shortage of medicines, particularly those vital for cancer patients. The journey to receive crucial life-saving medical care is fraught with numerous obstacles for cancer patients in Gaza. Israeli restrictions on freedom of movement have prevented Palestinian patients with serious illnesses from seeking urgent medical treatment beyond the blockaded territory.
Lack of medical equipment and Israeli obstacles are hurting cancer patients. Doctors here are tirelessly working to help us, but the resources are limited. I have throat cancer, and my treatment is not always available in Gaza. I call on all the people around the world to help alleviate our suffering.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer from acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment, experiencing a staggering 60% deficit rate. Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to deteriorate further. Israeli authorities also impose a ban on the entry of medical devices and equipment into the Gaza Strip, further weakening the provision of health services to cancer patients.